You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
Good afternoon and welcome to Soul to Soul. It's wonderful to be with you once more this Wednesday afternoon. In the beginning of our summer holidays, the spirit of holidays is upon us and many are going away. Wish all of our listeners safe travels and hope you have holy and uplifting holidays that are re-energizing for you and your families and wonderful quality times. And of course, spiritual growth as well. We're servants of Hashem even on holiday. So we have to make sure we keep halacha and keep connected and don't lose ourselves in the fun and the sun of the holidays. This time of year, we're fortunate that there is a very special Jewish holiday that comes around at this time. Which is a very powerful and important time in the calendar, a time that reminds us who we are and what we're doing and what the unique mission of the Jewish people is in this world. And that is, of course, the festival of Chanukah. Chanukah begins, the first night Chanukah is next Tuesday night, and Chanukah continues for 8 days, where we light the menorah at sunset. Candlelighting time, a little bit after sunset, is at 7:15 here in Johannesburg. And we light all for 8 days from Tuesday night until next Wednesday night. And we are supposed to think about wonderful things on Hanukkah. We also add certain prayers. We say Al Hanisim when we daven the Shmon Esrei, the Amidah. We include it in our benching as well. When we bench on the 8 days of Hanukkah, we say Hallel every day. We read the Torah every day because it's a important spiritual time. So let's try and understand a little bit, since we are discussing adventures in Jewish history, let's get the historical perspective as to what happened at the times of Chanukah and why this is and continues to be a very important festival within the Jewish calendar. So we have all heard of the great warrior Alexander. In the Gemara, it's called Alexander Mukdon, Alexander the Great as we know him. A tremendous military mind, a very brave warrior. At the very young age of 30, he had conquered most of the civilized world and was revered by his troops and his followers. And Alexander dies. He passes away and leaves much of his kingdom in tatters. There's a big disagreement after Alexander's death as to who's going to take over the kingdom. He dies in the year 323 before the Common Era. And as a result of there not being a powerful successor, the kingdom splits up. And we have the northern kingdom, which is called the Seleucid Kingdom, with its capital in Syria. And the southern kingdom, which is the kingdom of Ptolemy, in the south with the capital in Cairo in Egypt. And as long as there, so we could imagine Israel is right in the middle of these two kingdoms, which are the aftermath of the Greek Empire of Alexander. And when there was peace between the northern and southern kingdoms, so things were good in Israel, and there was trade, and there was a lot of movement, and people enjoyed prosperity. But when there was war, so Israel was right at the front lines in the middle of these two warring nations. And King Antiochus III, in 165 before the Common Era, defeated the Ptolemy kingdom and took over the entire region, including the land of Israel. When Ptolemy IV came into power, he was a ruthless dictator, and he enforced decrees upon the Jewish people in the land of Israel to prohibit them from studying Torah, from observing the Shabbos, from Bris Milah, from Rosh Chodesh. It was a very difficult and dangerous time for the Jewish people, and there was mass persecution, and the Greeks were relentless and merciless in their execution of these decrees. And so the Jewish people were facing a terrible dilemma. Would they give in to these pressures from the Greek occupying forces and leave the observance of the Torah and the mitzvahs and stop the holy tradition, the Masorah, the tradition that we received from Mount Sinai? Would they abandon that tradition due to the pressure that the Greeks were putting on them? Or would they be able to oppose and fight against the Greeks and stay true and loyal to our holy tradition? And there was a single individual by the name of Matisyahu. He was the Kohen Gadol. And Matisyahu had five sons. And together, together with his five sons, they decided to rebel against the Greeks, to attack the Greeks, and to wage war. And they successfully did so. It was a guerrilla war because they could never face the Greeks head on. And the Greek army was far too powerful for them. But they would have to engage in guerrilla tactics and ambush and attack and weaken and pester this great, mighty Greek war machine. And they did so successfully. You can imagine, it's a bunch of Talmid Chachamim, the Kohen Gadol and his five sons, a bunch of rabbis. They were not Navy SEALs. They were not well-tuned warriors, but they had to learn the art of guerrilla warfare, and they did so very successfully. And as the rebellion grew, so their support grew, and their ranks swelled, and eventually, miraculously, they were able to defeat the Greek forces. And when they finally got to the temple after the Greeks withdrew, in other words, they were such a pest in the side of the Greeks. I mean, they could never take them head on, as I mentioned earlier, a little bit like the Vietnam War, where the Viet Cong very cleverly selected the battles and the ambushes against the American forces. They knew if they took the Americans head on, they would be wiped out by far superior American firepower. And so very cleverly, they selected the battles and the confrontations, and they would only expose themselves and attack when they felt that they were in a superior position. And they constantly did that throughout the 5-6 years of the intense fighting of the Vietnam War. And they knew that the Americans wouldn't have the stomach for the fight, and eventually the American public opinion would turn, and the Americans would then have to withdraw. And they therefore very successfully operated in that conflict. And it's a similar kind of conflict at the times of Hanukkah, where the Jewish forces led by Matisyahu and his sons were also able to, it was a war of attrition, and they were able to pick off the Greek forces and were a real thorn in the side of the Greeks, until eventually this great powerful empire of Greece decided it wasn't even worth their while to continue to have to try and suppress this rebellion, and they left. And when the Matisyahu and his sons came to the Beis HaMikdash, to the temple, which had been destroyed by the Greeks. The Greeks had burnt it and had destroyed the kalim, destroyed the vessels that were used in the temple, and had desecrated it as best they could. But nonetheless, they still found one single jar of oil that had the seal of the Kohen Gadol. And the oil, the lighting of the menorah was an avodah, was one of the services in the temple, which was done each day. And in order for them to produce new oil, and that was tahor, that was pure, there were many laws of tumah and tahara, of purity and impurity with regards to the temple. In order for them to produce new tahor oil, olive oil, would take them a week to do so. And so they found this one jar, and they decided, look, we'll light it anyway and see what happens. And when we've produced new oil, then we'll continue to do the avodah, the service of the menorah each day. But this jar, which was only enough for one day, miraculously burned for 8 days. And this miracle became known as the miracle of Chanukah. And that's why our sages instituted that each year following that miracle, we too, each Jewish household, should light a menorah, a Chanukiah. We should light it, as I mentioned, at just after sunset, 7:15, it's candlelight time in Johannesburg. And we should each night add another candle in order to remember the great miracle of Chanukah, the nace of Chanukah. So there's much to be said about it. There are many important lessons to learn. But let's first just try and get a bit of insight into why is it that the Jewish people could not be tolerated by the Greeks. It's an interesting question, because Alexander was a very smart warrior and a very smart conqueror. When he conquered a nation, as he did to many different nations throughout Europe and the Middle East, his policy was not to tamper with the religious practices and outlooks of the local people, because then they would resent the occupation of the Greeks and they would rebel against them vociferously. And so Alexander generally laid down certain laws that had to be kept by the people, that were that were run and dispensed by the occupying forces of the Greeks, but he never got involved with spiritual practices and spiritual beliefs of the local nations, with one exception. And well, it wasn't at the times of Alexander, but it was later with his successors. They could not tolerate Israel and the Jewish people continuing our way of life and our observing the Torah. Why not? Why was the Jewish worldview the antithesis of the Greek worldview? Where do they differ and what is the clash? What does Jerusalem stand for? What does Athens stand for? And the answer is very clear. Athens was about beautifying the human form, was about the gymnasium that the Greeks invented, was about the great athletic competitions and sports that the Greeks introduced, was about Greek philosophy and perfection of the human mind. Athens was built around the primacy of man. And that was in direct conflict with Jerusalem, because Jerusalem is built around the primacy of God. And although Athens worships man and man's success and man's domination and human beauty that exists in this world through the body and through the mind, which is very seductive and very luring, and it's something that's very powerful, and it draws a person after that here in this physical material world that we live in. But Jerusalem demands of human beings to stretch beyond their physical selves, to stretch beyond the power of the human body, the power of the human mind, and to reach out to a force that is beyond us, that is higher than us, that is the source of all life. In Judaism, man is made B'Tselem Elokim. Man is made in the image of God. In Athens and in the other religions, so God is made in the image of man, B'Tselem Adam. And that's a very fundamental difference, because the Jewish view and understanding of God is omnipotent and God is perfect, and we have to strive beyond our mortal selves to access that spark of the divine within us, the Tzen Melokim, and to connect to that eternal perfection. That's the Jewish understanding and view of life. But the view of Greek philosophy and Greek culture was that the gods were made in the image of man. In other words, what man perceives as success and as powerful and as domination. So they superimposed that. They projected that on their gods. So they had a god of drinking that could drink as much as he wanted. It would never get a hangover with no consequences. And a god of eating and a god of sexual pleasure. So all of that was a superimposing of what they view, what humans beings viewed as being something to look up to, something to aspire for, something that would be ideal for a human to have, and they projected that onto godly figures. Whereas in Judaism, it's the opposite. We see God in God's perfect state and form, and we have to strive to that. We don't carve God out of our own image and our own perception. Judaism is, and Israel is God-directed. Athens is man-directed. And that is a very difficult worldview, a very different worldview, and a tremendous clash that the Greeks saw and had with the Jewish people, because they saw that the Jewish lifestyle, the Jewish values, the Jewish outlook was something that couldn't be tolerated based on Greek culture. And that's why, interestingly enough, if you look at the Hebrew word for Greece, for Greek, it's Yavan. For the ancient Greeks were the ancient Greeks were the Yavanim. And that's a Yud and a Vav and a Nun. If you can picture in your mind's eye, since this is radio and I can't show you a visual display of what I'm referring to, we'll have to imagine it in our minds. Imagine the Hebrew word, a letter Yud, which is a vertical, a very short vertical line. And then a Vav, which is a longer vertical line. And then a Nun Sufi, which is even a longer vertical line. So you've got three lines next to each other, one longer than the other. That's Yavan. Yeah, and that represents the worldview of the ancient Greeks, which was everything's about this world. Everything's about what can be measured and what is empirical in this world. You've got one line, another line, another line. That's the basis of Western culture, Western society, and of scientific development. That's Yavan. The Jewish people agree with that. They agree that we need to study this magnificent world that we live in and look at all the empirical evidence that exists in all the different fields. But there's a reason for it. It's not in and of itself. It's not in a vacuum, but rather that's all part of our divine mission. And that's why we call Tzion, Zion. Tzion is the three letters of Yavan, Yud Vav Nun, with a Tzadi in the front. The Tzadi, like the Tzadik, is the righteous individual. So we look at the world and the measurements and the empirical evidence, and we put a Tzadi in front of it, because the function of our existence, the reason why we're here, is in order to connect with God and to use everything in this material world in our journey and in our pursuit of the divine and of going beyond ourselves. So we are Tzion, and we are different to Yavan, which has a whole different approach to life. And in one sentence, Judaism is God-orientated, and Greek culture and Western society are man-orientated, because the basis of Western society comes from the Greeks. The Greeks were the foundation upon which the Romans built. The Romans took over after the Greeks, and we are the aftermath of Roman civilization, of the Roman culture. So Western society is very much man-orientated, as opposed to the Jewish religion, which is God-orientated. So the victory of the Jewish people and of Torah and of the rebellion against the Greeks was really a victory of Torah philosophy against Greek philosophy, of a world which is God-orientated versus a world which is man-orientated. And that's the symbol of the menorah. When they came to the Beis HaMikdash and they lit that menorah, it represented the light of God, the light of connecting to the divine force that created the world, that is all unknowing and omnipotent and perfect. And it's the victory of that light against the darkness of a very self-centered, limited worldview, which is all about man and human achievements and human pursuits in this world. So that's the celebration of Hanukkah, and that's the message that our rabbis wanted to remember. And especially as I mentioned, we are entering into our summer holidays, and it usually is quite a hedonistic environment that we find ourselves in. But that hedonism is really what the Greeks were about in Greek culture. Whereas we Jews, we strive for something beyond that. And we're not limited to our eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you will die. That's not what our existence is about. But rather we are connecting to the light of God and to the light of Torah and to the mission and purpose that all of us human beings have in this world, that nothing is random, nothing's by chance, that God created us for a specific purpose. Each and every one of us has a unique mission and role to play in this world. And there's no, none of us are superfluous. None of us are can be done without. We are vital to perfecting God's world, and we all have to play our part and our unique role in fulfilling our mission in this world. So that's the Jewish view, unlike the Greek view, which is just about the here and now and maximum pleasure and full-blown hedonism and enjoying our life in this world. The truth is that when you follow the worldview of Yisrael, of the Torah, of the Jewish people, so one does actually get maximum pleasure in this physical world. When this physical world is actually just a vehicle and a means to fulfill our spiritual mission, so one gets maximum pleasure from the physical world. It's a little bit counterintuitive. And when one's focused entirely only on physical pleasure and on this hedonistic existence, so one's left empty and one's left depressed and one's left constantly looking for more pleasure and for more cheap thrills, and they just don't fill up the soul, the godly soul that all of us have. So that's the main thrust of Hanukkah, of this time, and of this wonderful festival. And so we encourage everybody to fulfill the mitzvah of lighting the menorah at 7:15 each night from this coming Tuesday night. It should burn until at least an hour after Tzeis HaKochavim, after darkness. So it should burn for an hour and a half. And therefore we recommend using, if you're using candles, using big, longer candles, not just those birthday candles, because they burn for too short. And they should be burning, preferably one should use olive oil, because the miracle took place with olive oil. and one could easily buy at your local Jewish bookstore. You can buy the gloss. You can either of you, you know, ideally you should have your own menorah. So it's a good time to invest in a menorah that you'll use every year. And you put the glass cups in the menorah and put oil in them. You can put some water and fill them to the top of the oil. The oil burns a long time. You can buy wicks. The floating wicks are very easy to use. Also on sale at your local Jewish bookstore. And, so one should all make an effort. And you can use candles too. You can use, whatever candles you want, as long as they burn for an hour and a half. And, we should be making an effort to fulfill this important mitzvah of lighting the menorah each night of Hanukkah. And as each, night goes on, so we add another candle. We're always adding a candle to the left, and we light the new one for that day, and we continue to light to the right. We say the blessings. You can find that in your Sidur. We say the blessings of Sheikh Rishon Mitzvah Adlik Ne'er Shel Chanukah, that God commanded us with the mitzvahs to light the candles of Chanukah. We say a broch of She'asa Nisim La'avoseinu B'Amim Ha'im B'Zman Hazeh, that God did a mitzvah for our forefathers at this time of the year, and in their days, but at this time. And then the first night we say Shehecheyanu, but the other nights we don't say the blessing of Shehecheyanu. The place where to put the menorah is, the halacha is that it used to be that, in Eretz Yisrael too, the Gemara says you should put it at the entrance to your household, where you enter from the Rishus HaRabim, from the public thoroughfare into your private thoroughfare. That's where you should place the Chanukiah, the menorah. In Chutz La'aretz, outside of the land of Israel, in the diaspora, so we don't place our menorah outside, but rather, if you have a window that is visible from the street, you'll place it by that window. If you don't have a window that's visible from the street, which is often the case here in South Africa, we live behind our high walls. So in that instance, a person should light at the entrance to the room where one will be while the candles will be lit. So let's say you're lighting in the dining room, you'll light at the entrance to the dining room, put a little table at the entrance, and put your menorah on that table. It's opposite the mezuzah. So as you're walking through that doorway, on the right-hand side you have your mezuzah, on the left-hand side you have your menorah. Or if you're lighting in the lounge, you'll do it by the lounge, whichever room you're going to be in for that time. And one should make sure we fulfill this mitzvah of lighting the menorah. We're going to be back shortly and discuss some other very powerful messages that we should all take from this wonderful festival of Chanukah.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
Welcome back. We're talking about the festival of Chanukah, which begins on Tuesday night, this coming Tuesday night, and continues for 8 days. We discussed how Chanukah is a celebration of Jewish philosophy, of a Jewish outlook to life, as opposed to Greek philosophy. And the Jewish view of life is to connect to eternity, is God-centered, is about us stretching ourselves and going beyond our physical, limited, finite selves, as opposed to a Greek worldview, which is centered around human beings, around man, around the power and perfection of the physical and mental form of a human being. One of the things we say, during the 8 days of Chanukah, say Al Hanisim, say the special paragraph about we make reference to the miracles that took place at this time to our forefathers. In that paragraph of Al Hanisim that we say each time we say the Amidah and each time we say Birkat HaMazon, we bench. So in those words are Rabim Biyad Ma'atim, that many fell at the hands of the few. And as I mentioned earlier, the war was quite miraculous, and you had a few rabbis, you know, not well-trained soldiers fighting against the all-powerful Greek army, the superpower of the time. The Greeks were the first to introduce mercenaries, and so it was quite a miraculous battle that these untrained individuals were able to cause such havoc and be such a pest to the Greeks that they actually defeated them. And so it was many, literally many. You had massive Greek armies in the hands of a few, and the Greeks continued to send more and more soldiers as the rebellion gained momentum. And it was quite unbelievable that these few individuals destroyed so many well-trained Greek soldiers. Josephus, who was the great historian at the times of the Romans, 2,000 years ago, which was after the Greeks been in the land of Israel, had conquered the land of Israel. It was a few centuries later that the Romans then took over. So Josephus writes, he was in the year 50 before the Common Era, that the Jews were 10% of the Roman Empire at that time. So that was round about 5 million Jews. At that time, which was 2,000 years ago, there were 6 million Chinese in the world. So the Jewish population was very similar to the Chinese population. So if the Jewish nation would have followed the regular, normal, natural growth of a people, we would be a similar size to the Chinese people, which is about 1.6 billion people in the world today, Chinese people in the world today. How many Jews are there in the world today? We're about 14, 15 million Jews. So we still remained small because we'll always be rabim biyad me'atim, many in the hands of the few. We are few, and we will. God always wants us to be few, as the pasuk says, "Ma'at atem mikol amim," that you are few, the smallest of all the nations. So, there's a reason why God wants us to be small, because that causes us to realize how important and indispensable each and every one of us is. The famous story about the town, the little shtetl, that had 10 families were in the shtetl, and each day they were able to make the minyan. And one day, another family moved to town. Now they had 11 families. The next day at Shacharis, they only had 6 people. Because a guy wakes up and says, you know, what do you need me for? Why should I go? Let the other guy go. But when there's few, you realize that you're indispensable, and your participation and your playing your part is essential and critical. And that's how it is for the Jewish nation, is that we're small, we'll always be small, because God wants us to get this message and realize how important, critical each and every one of us is, and how each and every one of us has to play our part and do what we need to do in contributing to the development of the Jewish people. And if we need a raya, a proof for this in modern Jewish history, this was the time of the Greeks 2,500 years ago, where we were few that defeated the many, but we see the same miracles repeated itself in our times, in the last 70 years, where we see the war of independence of Israel, where 7 Arab armies declared war straight after Israel became a nation and declared its statehood and reached independence. And you had this tiny fledgling Jewish state that didn't even have a chance to catch its breath and to develop some infrastructure and develop, you know, an army. There was no Tzahal. There was no IAF, Israel Air Force. There were 650,000 Jewish refugees that were untrained, and most of them had survivors and had come from Europe and the destruction of the Jewish people during the Second World War. And you had millions and millions of Arabs from the Arab nations that declared war against Israel. And they had very well-trained, mechanized armies with the most advanced equipment at the time. And they, 7 Arab armies attacked Israel, attacked these 650,000 refugees. So if you look at normal course of nature, the normal, laws of how things work, so obviously these 650,000 should have been destroyed and should have been wiped out by the powerful Arab armies. But miraculously, they held on, and with tenacious courage and with an unbelievable stubbornness that is a trait of the Jewish people, they stood firm and they fought to the last bullet, most of the time using rifles from World War I because they didn't have weapons and military equipment, and they held off those 7 Arab armies. Nothing short of miraculous. It's the Hanukkah miracle in our time, 70 years ago. Quite unbelievable. Once again, we see Rabim biyad me'atim. If that's not enough, we see the Six-Day War, and we see, again, powerful Arab armies under the leadership of Nasser wanting to destroy the Jewish people, telling the world that they're going to wipe out every Jew that exists in the land of Israel, without any shame, openly saying that. And incredibly miraculously, in 6 days, Israel's able to repel these Arab armies and able to gain more territory and secure her borders, once more. Rabim Be'at Ma'atim, the miracles continue. The 73 war, there's a famous officer of the tank commander. His name is Avigdor Kaalan. He's actually a Rosh Hashiva today. He wrote a book about his experiences in the Yom Kippur War. And he writes that in the Emek HaBakar, which is a valley in the Golan, he was a commander of 70 Israeli tanks. They faced 1,400 Syrian tanks. That's unbelievable. That's 20 times more. 20 Syrian tanks per Israeli tank. And the Israelis held them off. The Israelis, in one battle in the Emek HaBakar, they shot out 300 Syrian tanks. Amazing. It's derech nice. It's not normal. Just like the battles in Hanukkah were not normal, so the battles of the wars of Israel are miraculous, are in the form of a miracle. So God shows us, not only in ancient times, but in modern times too, that Rabim Be'at Ma'atim, that we have the capacity when we stand strong and we are true to our tradition and to our holy tradition we received from Mount Sinai. If we are loyal to our past and carry on with the holy values of the Torah, with the observance of the Torah and the mitzvahs, and we stand firm for our beliefs, that we will endure and we will succeed and we will survive. It's only when we turn our backs on our holy tradition and when we turn away from the Torah and the mitzvahs and God's commandments and we don't want to be part of this covenant that God made with us at Mount Sinai, that's when we're truly vulnerable. And that's when we are exposed and we stand to God forbid, suffer at the hands of the nations. But when we're strong and loyal, so we see these miracles of Rabim Be'at Ma'atim. I want to continue with an amazing story, really one of the most amazing stories I've ever heard. I'll share it with you in a moment when we come back after this.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
We're discussing the historical relevance of Hanukkah, how Hanukkah represents a clash of civilizations and worldviews between the Jewish people and ancient Greek civilization. And that really is the basis of Western society, and the world, the view of secular Western society really runs in the face of the Torah view of life. And Western secular society is man-centered, is human-centered, whereas the Torah view is God-centered, and we strive to go beyond ourselves and connect with God. I want to share with you a story which I really think captures the spirit of Hanukkah in a very powerful way. It's a story that I heard from my Rebbe, Rabbi Beryl Wein. When Rabbi Wein was a young boy, 12 years old, he was brought up in Chicago, and He remembers very clearly this incident. I barely remember anything from my childhood below, you know, the age of 15. But anyway, listen to the detail with which he remembers the story. So Rabbi Herzog was the first chief rabbi of Israel. Rabbi Herzog came to visit the United States. And the first place he came to was Chicago. Rabbi Wein was a 12-year-old boy in Chicago, and he went together with his family and the whole religious community of Chicago to greet and to welcome this great man, the chief rabbi of Israel, Rabbi Herzog. And he said Rabbi Herzog was a very dignified person. He had a long gray beard and he carried one of these rabbinic canes with a silver head. And he always walked around with a tanakh, with a leather tanakh in his hand. And he came to the yeshiva, he gave them a shir. And then at the end of the shir, he put his head down and he said to them, he said, "I've just come from the Vatican. And I have documents which prove that more than 10,000 Jewish children are held by Catholic institutions in Europe, and they went there during the war to be saved from the persecution of the Nazis. And I presented these documents to the Pope, and I said to him, 'Let us have our children back, let them come home.' And the Pope refused, and he said no." And Rabbi Herzog then broke down in tears, in very bitter tears, and he was crying in front of those boys. Rabbi Wein said he'd never seen an adult, never mind such a distinguished and imposing figure, cry like that. And after crying for a few moments, he gathered himself, and Rabbi Herzog raised himself tall and strong, and he said, "There's nothing I can do for those children, but my question is, what are you going to do for the Jewish people?" there's something I can do for you. And he said to that crowd and that group of boys, he said, it's your responsibility to develop and contribute to Klal Yisrael, to the Jewish people. And you need to remember that and carry that with you your whole life. Rabbi Wein said throughout his life, those words have reverberated in his ears. And very often he's thought, what can I do for the Jewish people? And that's a question we should all ask ourselves. What can I do? What is my role? How can I contribute to Klal Yisrael, to the Jewish people? And that's something that Chanukah is telling us to do. Chanukah is telling us, Rabim Ba'ad Ma'atim, it was just a few who turned around and stood strong, and they made all the difference. And today they're just a few. We are Ma'atatem Mikol Amim. There's not many of us. We're a small nation. We're small numbers. But we all have a vital responsibility to play. And we have our contribution to make to the Jewish people and, of course, to humanity, to all of humanity. Because if we build Klal Yisrael, we build a strong Klal Yisrael. That means spiritually building Klal Yisrael. It means the greatest thing we can do for the Jewish people is to develop it spiritually. Develop ourselves spiritually and let that light shine. Let that light of the menorah shine in the darkness of this hedonistic world. Let that light of Torah come into our hearts and into our homes and into our lives. And let it shine for all of the world to see. What morality is, what monotheism is, what it means to work on yourself and go beyond your instincts that God created us with, and to reach out and connect with the divine, with something bigger than ourselves. That's our role as individuals, and we all are critically needed in that task. Klal Yisrael needs each and every one of us to play our part, and if we successfully do that, so then we will spread the light of God and of morality and of goodness to the entire world. And it's a dark world out there. It's a world of that's filled with taiva, with self-centeredness, with one's own pursuit of pleasures. And when we focus on something bigger than ourselves, not just what I can accumulate and enjoy in this world, so then we enter into a whole new realm, a realm of beauty and light and serenity and holiness. And that's what Chanukah is coming to tell us. Light that menorah, and let the light of Torah and the light of godliness shine in this world and dispel the darkness of hedonism. And when that light shines bright, we bring goodness and we bring peace and we bring holiness to ourselves, to our families, to our communities, and to all of the world. Thank you for listening and wishing you a Chanukah Sameach for next week.